Welcome, deep divers. We've all heard those stories, right? The kind of almost mythical tales about football prodigies, you know, innate D genius, this raw talent just like dribbling past everyone on the streets, thinking of a young Messi and Rosario maybe, just waiting to be discovered. It's a really powerful image. But here's what we're digging into today. Is that actually still the reality for today's rising stars? Or has the whole pathway to elite football completely changed? This deep dive, we're basically deconstructing the modern blueprint for developing elite football talent. We're crawling from this great piece, The Prodigy Pathway, deconstructing the genesis of elite football talent and, you know, other research too, all to really understand what it takes now to go from that neighborhood kickabout to, well, professional debut. And we're tackling a really core question here, one that came up in an online discussion recently that got us thinking. Someone asked Messi, Yapball, Max Damman, how do they start? Would it ever be possible for some kid in any neighborhood to be that good? And would they ever be noticed if they were? Yeah, that question really nails it, doesn't it?
So our mission today, explore how this pathway has shifted. What actually defines that it factor? How these elite academies work as sort of super factories, and maybe most importantly, look at the systemic barriers, the things that act as a great filter on finding talent. We'll compare journeys like Messi's, Lamine Yamal's, Max Dauman, Rio and Gumoya. They all kind of represent different eras. Hopefully we'll uncover some surprising stuff for you. Okay, let's dive in. Right, let's start with the origin story, how these players begin. If you look at Lionel Messi, his journey really started super local, joined Grandoli, his neighborhood club, age 4. His dad coached him, then Newell's Old Boys at 7. All deep in that Argentinian football culture, you know. It wasn't until he was 13 that he made the huge move to Barcelona, to La Masia, which was massive for his career, obviously, but also for his growth hormone treatment.
And that timeline, it's absolutely key, because it shows just how dramatically things have shifted. Compare Messi leaving Argentina at 13 to, say, Lamine Yamal, scouted by Barca at 6, signed at 7, or Max Dauman into Arsenal system around 5 or 6, Rio and Gumoya at Chelsea by 8.
Wow, 6 years old.
Exactly. The discovery window hasn't just tweaked, it's plummeted from maybe a talented 13-year-old to a promising 6-year-old. And this hyper-early start, well, it puts immense pressure psychologically, developmentally on these kids. It means you absolutely need these incredibly robust, holistic support systems in place. We can talk more about that later.
That shrinking window is huge.
Yeah.
And it makes you think immediately about that classic comparison. Street football versus the structured academy. We love romanticizing the legends honed on the streets, don't we?
We do, and for good reason. Street football, it's unstructured, tight spaces, maybe uneven ground. It forces players like Messi, Neymar, Mahrez to develop this almost instinctive technical skill, creative flair. You have to problem solve constantly, control the ball incredibly well, make decisions super fast, just to keep up, really. That environment is, well, invaluable.
So if that's true, are the modern academies, are they losing something important by systematizing everything? Are they maybe sacrificing that kind of unpredictable genius for efficiency?
That's the constant tension, isn't it? Academies aren't ignoring those lessons, not at all. They're actually trying to build them into the structure. You see it with the massive use of small-sided games. 3v3, 4v4 drills. That's a direct attempt to replicate street football.
Right, maximizing touches, quick decisions under pressure.
Exactly, mimicking that fluid chaos. Arsenal's Hail End, for instance, their whole philosophy is about mastering the ball, dominating possession, using these methods. But yeah, the question is still there. Can this systematization, which is definitely efficient, truly nurture that unpredictable, maybe maverick player, the kind that unstructured play naturally seems to produce?
It's a really interesting trade-off. And okay, underneath all of this, for every single prodigy, there's the family. Their role is way beyond just, you know, cheering from the sidelines.
Oh, absolutely. The family is the foundation. It's relentless logistics, all those hours driving to training, right? It's financial support fees, kit, and crucially, emotional stability. Parents are often the main social agents guiding these young athletes managing these huge demands.
The sacrifices are just incredible sometimes. Messi's family moving continents for his treatment and career. That's immense.
Lamine Yamal's story, too, it highlights a complex family situation, his grandmother playing such a key role. It's not just supporting a hobby, it's like rearranging your whole life. Yeah, you used the term startup enterprise earlier, and it's actually spot on.
Right.
The family becomes the small, highly specialized unit. Parents are like the founding investors, making these high-risk, potentially high-reward decisions. And what that reveals is that raw talent on its own often isn't enough. You also need to be born into a family with the social, emotional, and, let's be honest, the financial capital to even start this journey.
It's a huge barrier, often invisible.
Exactly. And that ties directly into the systemic issues, the great filter we'll get to later.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. Let's talk about that magic ingredient, the it factor.
Yeah.
What really makes a prodigy stand out, it's clearly not just being physically better or technically amazing. It's something deeper, right? This advanced cognitive ability, soccer IQ.
That's it. It's like the invisible software running the show. The ability to read the game, understand really complex patterns, anticipate what's going to happen next, and then make the best decision under huge pressure.
And there's that insight from Dan Blank, that coaching expert players spend something like 96% of the game without the ball.
A massive amount, yeah. And that's crucial. High soccer IQ is mostly about mastering that off-ball time. Constantly scanning, predicting the next pass, intelligent positioning. It's the work they do before they get the ball that makes the difference.
So when we see, like, a Messi splitting the defense with a pass that seems impossible, it looks spontaneous, but it's actually the result of intense cognitive work.
Precisely. Scanning, predicting, analyzing, deciding, all happening before the ball even gets to him. Which is why scouts, well, they absolutely have to watch what players do off the ball. Their awareness is key.
Okay, so Dan Blank's framework breaks this down. What are the pillars?
Yeah, it gives us a good way to analyze it. First up is speed of play. And this isn't just running fast. It's speed of thought and execution. Thinking one touch is faster than two. Knowing a moving ball is the fastest thing out there. It's a conscious choice to play quickly, to basically shrink time and space for the opponent.
And driving that speed is constant awareness. That mental engine asking, what if? What next? And maybe most importantly, what's behind me? That constant scanning, head on a swivel.
Exactly. Gathering info before you need it so you can act faster than the defense can react.
It makes sense. What else?
Then you've got mastery of passing and receiving. Seems basic, but the details matter. Receiving the ball on the foot furthest from the defender buys you time. Passing to a teammate's proper foot sets them up instantly. Moving into those seams, the gaps between defenders, that unlocks everything.
And then there's the clever stuff, proactive movement and deception.
Right. How elite players manipulate defenders, using two runs, a fake run, then the real one. Or pre-fakes, like a little shoulder drop, just enough to unbalance someone and create that half-second advantage.
It even applies to defending.
Oh, yeah. Intelligent defending. Tactical smarts. Positioning yourself to force an attacker onto their weaker foot. Cutting off the return pass to win the ball back quickly and maybe start a counter. If you look at all these together, they form this kind of cognitive loop. Scan, anticipate, decide, execute, move. Elite players just run this loop faster and more efficiently than everyone else.
So coaching needs to train that whole loop, not just isolated skills.
Exactly. That's why things like positional games, where you focus on shape and passing lanes and rondos, the keep ball drills, are so valuable. They train the whole decision-making process in context.
Okay, that clarifies the tactical side of soccer IQ. But what about the innate stuff, the actual mental wiring? What does research say about a prodigy's brain and personality?
Well, the research is pretty interesting. Academically, elite players tend to show superior fluid intelligence. They're better at abstract reasoning, planning, complex problem solving. Their working memory is often better, too.
Like remembering sequences of numbers?
Yeah, exactly. One study showed elite players remembering, on average, 6 digits compared to just over 4 for others. They also excel at visuospatial reasoning, understanding shapes and spaces, which is obviously critical on a pitch.
And personality-wise, does the Big Five model tell us anything?
It does. Using those broad traits, conscientiousness, extroversion, openness, neuroticism, agreeableness prodigies generally score higher on conscientiousness, meaning they're disciplined, organized, higher on extroversion, often more outgoing, and higher on openness, so curious, imaginative. Conversely, they tend to score lower on neuroticism, meaning less prone to anxiety, and also lower on agreeableness.
Lower agreeableness, so more competitive, less compliant.
Exactly. More competitive, maybe a bit more stubborn, less likely to just go along with things. And here's the real kicker, the paradox. They need this blend of profound coachability, that high conscientiousness, the desire to learn, and this fiercely independent, competitive drive, the lower agreeableness.
Well, so a disciplined soldier, but also a creative general.
That's a great way to put it. It's this specific kind of rare psychological cocktail that seems critical. And identifying that is a huge part of modern talent ID.
Okay, so a club spots this potential, this rare cocktail. They bring the player into the academy system, which we're calling the super factory.
Mm.
And these places, they're way more than just training grounds, aren't they? They're these
like holistic environments designed to manage every single aspect, technical, tactical, physical, psychological, even education.
Absolutely. And this super factory approach, it's not just about being thorough. It reflects this huge desire for certainty and talent development. It's almost an attempt to industrialize the discovery of talent. If you look at Arsenal's Hale End, for example, it's got this highly specialized structure, an academy manager per Mertes Sacker currently overseeing everything, then head coaches for every single age group, U9 right up to U21. And even within those groups, you have coaches specializing in team tactics, others on individual technique, others focusing just on decision making.
It sounds like a finely tuned machine. Arsenal has their strong young gunners philosophy, right?
Mm.
Built on four pillars.
That's right. Effective team player, most efficient mover, lifelong learner, and champion mentality. And then they use individual development plans, IDPs, to tailor everything for each player based on those pillars.
But does this extreme optimization, this focus on minimizing risk, does it risk squeezing out that maverick quality, the messy type who maybe didn't fit the mold perfectly early on?
That is the fundamental tension, yes. The academy functions almost like a hyper-specialized university. It has its own philosophy, its faculty, curriculum, individualized plans. It's incredibly comprehensive. But it definitely raises that question. Can such a structured system fully nurture a true outlier? Someone whose genius maybe lies outside the defined pathways.
And for those really exceptional talents within the system, a key strategy is fast-tracking. Why do they do that? Why push them so hard so young?
Fast-tracking is basically moving a prodigy up to play with much older age groups. It's done to match their advanced ability level, accelerate their development, and crucially, prevent them from stagnating. If a player is miles ahead of their peers, keeping them there isn't challenging them. It's about aligning the challenge with their actual ability, not just their birth year. Keep them stimulated, keep them pushed.
And we see this happening quite aggressively now. Max Dalman at Arsenal U18s at 13, UEFA Youth League in PL2 at 14, Premier League debut at 15, Lamine Yamal at Barcelona, a similar incredibly rapid rise.
Huh.
But this must be incredibly high stakes. What are the risks involved in pushing kids that fast?
Oh, immensely high stakes. The risks are significant. Physical overload is a big one. Psychological burnout is another major concern. And social isolation, being so much younger than your teammates, these are very real dangers. That's why it absolutely requires this holistic, multidisciplinary approach. Sports scientists, psychologists, player care staff, they all have to be involved, constantly assessing if the player is mentally and physically ready for each step up.
So a successful fast track is a win for the whole system.
Exactly. It's a triumph of that integrated support. But a failed fast track, that's a catastrophic system failure. It impacts the player hugely, obviously, but also the club's reputation, their investment.
And to manage these risks, the academies have this amazing support matrix.
Yeah.
You mentioned player care, safeguarding, education. It's a whole wraparound system.
It really is. And there's a huge focus now on mental performance. Dedicated sports psychologists, specialist coaches helping players develop skills like managing pressure, maintaining focus, building resilience, confidence, goal setting. Mental toughness is seen as a massive differentiator. This is all combined with sophisticated sports science. Using GPS tracking to monitor every meter run in training, analyzing workload data to optimize performance, and crucially, mitigate injury and burnout risks.
I heard about scouts even deliberately causing a mistake in a drill just to watch how a young player reacts emotionally.
Yes, that level of scrutiny exists. It's about understanding the whole picture. How do they handle adversity? How quickly do they problem solve?
And it's not just football. There's real emphasis on education too, right? A plan B.
Definitely. Strong collaborations with schools, tailored educational pathways. Providing that crucial plan B is part of the duty of care. Plus, mentorship programs like Declan Rice, mentoring Max Dauman, that provides invaluable real-world guidance.
So thinking bigger picture, what does all this investment mean for the clubs?
Ultimately, this entire support structure is a sophisticated form of risk management. Clubs are pouring huge resources, making long-term bets on these young players. This comprehensive system is designed to protect that investment, maximize the chances of success, and create a more sustainable, maybe less luck-dependent model for developing top talent.
Okay, so this brings us right back to where we started, that listener's question. Would it ever be possible for some kid in any neighborhood to be that good? And would they ever be noticed if they were?
Yeah, and to really answer that, we have to look closely at modern scouting. It's this blend now, isn't it? Traditional boots on the ground observation, watching games, getting that gut feeling, but it's combined with rigorous data analysis, trying to capture both the tangible skills and those harder-to-measure intangibles.
And scouts, they're looking for much more than just, you know, silky skills. They're assessing character, temperament, leadership potential,
yeah,
and especially how a player reacts to things going wrong, mistakes, criticism.
Absolutely. I've even heard of digital platforms logging things like how a player reacted after scoring an own goal. It gives insights into their mental strength, their resilience.
So scouts are almost like risk assessors.
That's a very good way to put it. They're evaluating the upside, sure, but they're also constantly assessing the psychological and character factors that might cause a player to fail down the line. Which means, even at a really young age, players are implicitly expected to show professional-level temperament, a moment of petulance, a visible lack of resilience. That could genuinely be a red flag that stops a club taking a chance, even on a brilliant talent.
But here's where we hit that major obstacle, that great filter we talked about, the socioeconomic barriers, especially the pay-to-play model you see in places like the U.S. It seems like a massive wall filtering out huge numbers of kids from lower-income backgrounds.
It is a formidable barrier. The costs are just huge. Average American parents, what is it, nearly $900 a season on youth sports. Soccer averages almost $1,200 a year. And if you're talking elite travel teams, the ones where scouts are most likely to be watching, you're talking thousands of dollars.
Which is totally different from many places in Europe or South America, where it's often community-funded, free, or heavily subsidized.
Exactly. And the disparity is stark. Research shows the wealthiest families spend about 4 times more on youth sports, those elite travel teams. They're 3 times less likely to have kids from low-income households. Back in 2021, I think the figure is only 24% of low-income kids regularly played sports, compared to 40% of kids from high-income families.
So, what does this mean for that kid, the one from any neighborhood with amazing potential? It paints a pretty bleak picture for answering our listener's question.
It does. Unequivocally, the pay-to-play system acts as a kind of socioeconomic pre-scout. Your family's income level becomes a primary filter before your talent even gets a look in. It largely determines whether you even get access to the competitive environments where the scouts are actually looking. The system, as it stands in many places, is inherently biased, and that means we're losing an immeasurable amount of potential talent simply because kids come from disadvantaged backgrounds.
So, to put it bluntly, that kid from any neighborhood, no matter how good they are, they're probably not going to get noticed if they can't get into that expensive ecosystem.
The odds are heavily stacked against them, yes. If they can't access that high-cost, pay-to-play world, their chances of discovery are dramatically reduced.
Okay, so given this huge systemic problem, what's being done? Are there initiatives trying to level the playing field at all?
Thankfully, yes, there are efforts. You see things like free-to-play models emerging, scholarship programs, the Open Goal Project, the Edgar Family Foundation are examples. They directly tackle that cost barrier.
And there are also community programs, right? Like the U.S. Soccer Foundation, Soccer for Success, or Soccer Without Borders, working with refugee kids, bringing the game to the neighborhoods.
Exactly. Those are crucial because they remove both the cost and often the transportation barriers. Even things like equipment redistribution, the Gift of Soccer Foundation, the Passback Program, they make a difference on the ground.
But you still feel these are patches, band-aids.
They are vital, absolutely vital. But yes, currently they function mostly as necessary patches on what is fundamentally an inequitable system in many parts of the world. They address symptoms, but maybe not the root cause.
So if these are just patches, what would it actually take to really level the playing field? What's the bigger shift needed?
Well, I think truly leveling the playing field needs more than just charities and local initiatives, however great they are. It really requires a kind of philosophical shift in how we fund and structure youth sports at a national level. A shift towards ensuring that talent, genuine potential, is the main determinant of opportunity, not how much money your parents have. It's about maybe viewing access to youth sports and the development opportunities they bring as more of a fundamental right for kids rather than a consumer good or a luxury. Hashtag Tech Hat Dattro.
So there you have it. The journey from that neighborhood kickabout to a pro debut. It's transformed. It's now this incredibly structured, intense, systematically managed process. The modern prodigy blueprint is, well, it's complex. It needs that innate ability, yes, but also the right early environment, that sophisticated academy acceleration, and crucially, access to the whole system.
And despite all the science, all the structure, that great filter of socioeconomic barriers, it's still very much there. That kid in any neighborhood, however brilliant they might be, they're still facing huge odds of ever being discovered if they can't break into that expensive ecosystem where the scouts are looking.
Which leaves us with a really thought-provoking question, maybe something for you to ponder after this. The question isn't really whether the next Messi exists out there somewhere. It's whether the system, as it's currently set up, is actually designed to find him. And right now, that answer feels pretty uncertain. We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, perhaps more critical, look at the modern football talent pathway and, you know, the real-world implications of how it works, biases and all. Definitely something to think about regarding the future of football talent globally. We'll catch you next time for another deep dive.